Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. Today, we're going to take a slightly different look into the future. As you probably know, Adam Taggart and myself have a new book out called Prosper, and that walks the reader through things they can do individually to prepare for what is certain to be a very disruptive future. However, there's another quiet form of disruption happening to people's jobs and lives right now, and it's only going to increase in the future. I'm talking about robotics. Automation is completely reshaping the entire global economic order, and it could threaten to completely undo literally everything about how we value time, money, and even find meaning in our lives. Now, how could it do all that? To help us understand that is one of our very favorite and most thoughtful guests, Charles Hughes Smith. Charles has a new book out on this topic. It's entitled, A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All. The future belongs to work that is meaningful. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
Now, that's a really big title, and it's a really big concept. So let me open this up. I want to quote a recent Ambrose Evans Pritchard piece in The Telegraph. Just came out about a week ago in early November 2015, and it reads, "The pace of disruptive technological innovation has gone from linear to parabolic," says Bank of America. "Robotics and robots will take over 45% of all jobs in manufacturing and shave $9 trillion off labor costs within a decade, leaving great swaths of the global society on the historical scrap heap." In a sweeping 300-page report, 300 pages I haven't read yet, but I will. I'll look at some of it. Bank of America predicts that robots and other forms of artificial intelligence will transform the world beyond recognition as soon as 2025, shattering old business models in a whirlwind of creative disruption, with transformation effects ultimately amounting to $30 trillion or more each year. Help us understand that. Is this a hyperbolic report from Bank of America potentially, or are they onto something here?
Well, Chris, it's only one of almost a flood of automation-related stories. There was a big McKinsey report called The Four Fundamentals of Workplace Automation that came out that same week. And just today, there was a big piece that a speech by a guy from the Bank of England. He extrapolates that as many as 80 million U.S. jobs could be at risk from automation. Well, there's only about 130 million jobs, of which 27 million are part-time. So 80 million is like pushing 65% of the total labor force. So even if the guy is wrong by half, as you say, then we're still talking 40, 45, 50% of all jobs being wiped out or replaced by software, AI, and robots.
Well, this raises so many questions. I don't even know where to begin. I mean, first of all, what do you do if nobody's working? Then in our model, who ends up buying any of your products? That's one. And then the second thing that pops up in my mind, I want to get to both of these, is isn't this just sort of like, isn't this what capitalism has always done, which is to take highly labor-intensive processes, capitalize them, create a more automated, streamlined process? Isn't this automation just really another evolution in this streamlining process? So part of this feels like capitalism to me, but the first thing I mentioned, capitalism doesn't work if everybody's out of work. So I don't know how to put these two pieces together.
Yeah, you know, Chris, it's interesting that we know that automation has been a force in the global economy since the beginning of the first industrial revolution in the 19th century. And of course, the initial wave of creative destruction of labor was what led Karl Marx to extrapolate the end of capitalism in a social, political, economic implosion, because he could see that as automation lowered the value of labor, people had very little money, and capitalism itself has no real means to, or really any interest in employing people at wages that don't allow for profit. You know, so in other words, there's an internal tension to capitalism, because capitalism has one simple law. The capital has to grow and it has to create profits. And if it doesn't do that, then that enterprise or organization will eventually go out of business. You know, it'll eat through its capital as it loses money, and then it will shut its doors. And so we can disagree about the goal of capitalism or say that it's a bad system or whatever we want. But the bottom line is, if it can't create a profit and expand its capital, it will go out of existence. And it's a very Darwinian system. So in my mind, it's creating two sort of memes that are developing as solutions to this automation problem of the destruction of labor. One camp holds that technology always creates more jobs than it destroys, and that that's proposed as sort of a natural law. You know, like, regardless of anything else, you know, technology always creates more jobs than it destroys, because that's what it's done through the first two industrial revolutions. But I'm not so sure that's true, and here's why. Each previous complete disruption of the global economy by, you know, the destruction of entire industries and employment created a lot of new entry-level jobs. So the guy that lost his job on the farm in 1890 or 1910, he went to a Ford factory where he was taught his job in the factory line in 5 minutes. So he didn't really need any special knowledge to go become an industrial worker at a Ford plant. It took 5 minutes to show him how to put this part on this thing, and then you just do this 8 hours a day for the rest of your life, and welcome to the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. And then the second Industrial Revolution of telephony, radio, and, you know, marketing, consumption, consumer credit, all the things that developed in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. There was a lot of entry-level jobs there for sales and telephone switch operators, and millions of relatively low-skilled jobs were created. This industrial revolution that's digital and software, it's not creating tens of millions of entry-level jobs, and it never will.
And it never will because?
Because the profit that's... profit only flows to what's scarce. And so what's scarce is, it used to be what was scarce was a high level of skills so that you'd get high wages for those high skills. And capital itself was scarce. And so then capital earned a good return, right? And so as economist Michael Spence and some of his colleagues have described recently, the problem is labor is no longer scarce. There's an abundance of people with college degrees. There's a bunch of people that have entry-level skills. I mean, essentially hundreds of millions of people have surplus labor. And then capital is no longer scarce either. It's in vast abundance, which is why the interest rate you earn on capital is a tenth of 1%. Mm-hmm. So Spence says that there's a third kind of capital. And it's the kind of capital that we talk about at Peak Prosperity, because it's the capital of social capital, intellectual capital, of new ideas, new business models. And so all the profit in the global system is flowing that way. And so the question for an entrepreneur or a business owner is, if I hire some entry-level person at $15 an hour or, you know, whatever the wage is, can I make a profit off that person's labor? And increasingly the answer is no, you can't. And if you can't make a profit off that person's labor, you're going to go out of business. You're going to be eliminated from the economic gene pool.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And of course, there's another trend pushing under all that, which is to have an employee, particularly if you're in Europe, France, I'll pick on France. That's a major, major investment, potentially a lifelong investment if you're in a country like France. But even here in the United States, to take on an employee is not to find somebody you're paying for $8.15 an hour or whatever the minimum is at this point. You're signing up for a whole lot of bookkeeping, record keeping, OSHA laws. You're signing up for potentially Obamacare. You're signing up for workman's comp. There's a giant raft of things that go along with that. Certainly none of those sorts of overages or complexities apply to a robot, do they?
No, Chris, and I think as a I used to hire when I was a building contractor, I hired a lot of dozens of people at various times, and I learned the hard way that you can pretty much double the wage that the person is earning. Your employee is getting $10 an hour. It's costing you, the employer, about 10 bucks to cover workers' comp, disability insurance, unemployment insurance, all the labor overhead you mentioned. And of course, the problem is, Chris, is the labor overhead is rising by leaps and bounds because it includes health care, which goes up like 7.5% a year, while the economy is growing at 1, 2, 3% a year, and wages are like stagnant. But to the employer, the costs keep going up. So the employee might not see any raise at all, or he might get a 10 cents more an hour, but the employer is seeing much higher costs. And that's true in the US as well, despite the reputation of being like a low labor cost society. That's no longer true.
Well, let's talk about that labor for a second. One report I read said that the threshold for when somebody business might decide to go with a robot over a worker is if the robot is 15% cheaper on an hourly basis than say an employee. So, looking at American and Japanese car industries right now, it costs, once you factor in the total cost of ownership for a robot, it costs $8 an hour to employ a robot for spot welding. Now, we compare that to about $25 an hour for a worker, but as you say, you might have to almost double that number to get the true fully burdened cost of having an employee. But even just comparing the 8 to the 25, that's a no-brainer, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other dynamic here, Chris, which I know you're aware of, is that the cost of robots and software are declining rapidly. So a robot that used to cost $40,000 now costs $22,000. And so these two lines are crossing in the wrong direction for hiring. In other words, the cost of labor keeps going up, and the cost of robotics and software keeps going down. And these are not trends that are limited to any one area. And this was there's a guy, Emmanuel Wallerstein, a socioeconomist who's famous for proposing the way that we understand our whole economic and social system is called a world system, and that includes the economy and the society that economy supports and creates. And so he's pointed out that it's a global phenomenon, the cost of labor rising, and it's due to urbanization, it's due to the externalization of costs finally coming due to the demands on governments for more of everything in terms of social services, education, so that's why wages in China have tripled in the last decade as well. So it's not just the US, it's or France, it's everywhere. So that's why we have a global problem, is that automation and software are getting cheaper and cheaper, and in the case of software, free. And like for instance, I just have heard that AutoCAD, which produces the software used to design all kinds of widgets, CAD systems, they've just released almost a free version of their powerful software. In other words, they've realized they can't sell this thing for thousands of dollars per copy anymore, and so they've made it available for a very low cost. And so this is giving really powerful tools to anybody with a few bucks. And that means, yeah, that so then therefore they can automate more work at a much lower entry price.
So let me, some of this gets lost, I think, for the average listener because it's a big world, and so what if one factory goes slightly more automated over there in Tennessee somewhere? But let's just, I like to do this, thought time. Let's just go silly. Let's pretend I just invented a machine today where I can produce anything in the world, from a car to a radio to toilet paper, it doesn't matter, but I can produce anything cheaper than anybody else can with my big fancy robot. Cost me a bunch of capital to build this thing, but it literally, I am the only source of products in the world because I can undercut everybody. Doesn't that sort of lay bare where this is all going? That how can it be that one person with one machine has all of the capital of the world, is producing all of the goods, and everybody else is doing what exactly?
That's right, Chris. That's extending this trend to the sort of singularity, if you will. And so The second sort of solution meme that's out there is, well, let's just tax your one guy, you know, the owner of the robot.
Okay.
Or all the owners of the robots, and we'll tax the heck out of them, and then we'll use that money to fund a guaranteed income for every household. And this has been catching a lot of interest because it appeals to people's innate sense for social justice. Like, well, gee, if there's no more jobs or only half of the workforce can find a job, then we're going to have to support the other half so they can buy all the stuff, the goods and services they need to live, and also, you know, all the goods and services that are produced. And so in my book, I go through this by actually putting some numbers, because actually all these people that are suggesting this is a wonderful idea and a real solution, they never put any numbers on the page. Like, where's the money going to come from? How much money are we talking about? Can those owners of robots generate enough profit that we can tax them to fund this? So if again, we're just going to throw out a few numbers, and I hope I won't lose the audience too much, but just as an example, the federal government of the U.S. spends $3.2 trillion. State and local governments spend another $3 trillion. So the government, as it is right now, without any guaranteed income for everybody, is already spending $6.2 trillion out of a $17 trillion economy. So it's already sucking up about 35-40% of the entire GDP. Now, we don't know how much more it's going to cost to give a guaranteed income to every household, but if, you know, 40 million people lose their jobs, we can anticipate that $6.2 trillion is not going to be enough. You know,
no.
It's another $3 trillion. $4 trillion, another $6 trillion. I mean, we're talking about huge amounts of money that we're going to have to acquire. So let's take a really super profitable business like Facebook. You know, I mean, it mints money, right? And its gross margins are 40% or something. It makes a little under $3 billion in profit. Well, that means we need 2,200 Facebooks just to fund the current federal government. Now, then we'd need another 2,000 Facebooks to fund the state and local governments. Mm-hmm. But guess what? There's only one Facebook. There's not going to be 2,000 Facebooks. It already dominates its entire sector. And the same goes for Google and all these and Apple, you know, these highly profitable firms. If we took every cent of their profit, we would be only have a tiny slice of the current federal revenues, never mind the money needed to fund another 30-40 million households guaranteed income. So it just simply doesn't work. And you know, Chris, there's another reason it doesn't work is automation cuts profits too. Because if I can buy a robot for $22,000 and slash my labor and generate more profit, well, you can buy the same robot. So the barriers to entry for competitors keeps dropping, you know, as instead of requiring, like if you were going to start an engineering firm to design a lot of great stuff and the AutoCAD program was, you know, $3,000 per engineer. Well, now it's $100. Well, what's to stop me from hiring some engineers and giving them the $100 software? So the process of automation is actually just devastating to profits. And I think we can look at some of these big firms like IBM that are seeing their sales and profits absolutely implode. I think this is evidence that this process is already well underway.
Well, it does seem ridiculous to think that we would be able to sort of tax under the current system as it's structured, given how money operates, right? And we understand, particularly at peak prosperity, there's a growth imperative built into our money system that has nothing to do with humans' need for growth or the factual realities of the world being a finite place. But we have this money system, and it's pretty insistent on this idea that it needs to grow. So if we have that money system and we're trying to then, you know, keep inflation at a few percent so our banks don't implode and let the banks just siphon off tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars every year from the system, that all has to get siphoned off from the productive class and as well, all the taxes that would have to be siphoned off to give to the families who are no longer working. I mean, what you really have is that then your manufacturing class, such as it is really the only wealth-producing engine on your in your country, and you have to tax them at a high enough rate so that everybody else can live the life they feel they're accustomed to and deserving of. It just, have you run the numbers? That just, I mean, you know, with the Facebook example, you take it one direction, but it just, that feels fundamentally unworkable to me.
Yeah, I think it is. It is, Chris. And as you point out, the system is set up not just for stagnation. If we don't grow the money supply and pay more interest and pay more taxes, the system basically implodes. And so that's the other thing we have to ask is a huge percentage of the federal revenues and state and local government revenues come from wages, taxes on payroll. So if payrolls are slashed by 45%, where is the government going to get all that money? And the people who say, well, we're just going to tax the owners of robots, well, they forget that one feature of automation is it commoditizes everything it makes. And that's products and services. So that's why having a call center or having a factory can be anywhere in the world. And so if some place like the United States decides it's going to tax all the owners of robots' profits at 95% to fund its guaranteed income, well, guess what? Everybody is going to leave. They're going to move their robots to some other country because they really have no choice. If they don't grow capital and make a profit, then they're going to go out of business.
Yeah.
So that the two solutions that have been that are constantly offered to automation. Number one, that technology always magically creates more jobs than it destroys. That seems false.
Wait, and let me add to that one before you go to number two.
Yeah.
I think that many of those observers who say that the technologies always come with greater jobs is might be confusing correlation with causation, right? So one of the other dynamics that we had up until about 1972 or three in this country was we had rising per capita energy coming from oil, right? So if you remember, that was the golden years, like 1950s, 60s, early 70s. People were like, woo, one income households, it's sort of balanced. And starting in the mid-70s, it went downhill to the point that you can't even get by on two incomes if you're both earning minimum wage at this particular point. So the fact that we always had more jobs being created during a long stretch of history might have been due to new technology. It might have been due to that, plus the fact that we also had abundant surplus energy there to do whatever we wanted with. So I just always want to hold that one out. To me, it's a very interesting observation that right around the time per capita oil production in the United States maxed out, things started to get progressively and steadily a little bit more difficult for the middle class. A whole host of reasons impinging on that as well. But to me, that's a piece in this. Okay, so step one, part one of what you're saying is there's potentially a fallacy here around this idea that new technology always creates more jobs. I will weigh in on the plus side of that. And number two.
Yeah, and number two is that we can tax the owners of robots and software to fund guaranteed income for all. But, you know, Chris, you raise a very good point about jobs, that it's not just a function of technology, that it's energy and it's also the way that we create money. And mm-hmm. as you have often discussed with Mish and John Rubino and myself on podcast in the last couple of years, the way our money system works is essentially free money is created and given to those at the top of the pyramid, who can then use that money to enrich themselves further. And the general idea in, you know, economics 101 is, oh, well, when Joe and Susie capitalists borrow $1 billion for almost nothing, that somehow is going to magically create a lot of jobs. And what we've seen is the money flows into stock buybacks, which doesn't create a single job, or it flows into overbidding for apartment buildings in London and this kind of thing, where the new owners jack up the rents to make more money, and they didn't create any jobs doing that either. The amount of maintenance on that apartment complex is the exact same before and after the new owner bought it for a gazillion dollars and then doubled the rents. So the money that's being created is flowing into completely non-productive, hyper-financialized ways of of greatly expanding wealth that don't create a single job.
God, it's almost like you're saying that creating debt money doesn't create jobs.
Yes, I'm afraid that's true. as Mish and others have pointed out, what this dynamic of lowering the cost of money to near zero while the cost of labor keeps rising, it creates, basically it puts every business in a vice. The vice is crushing them, that the cost of money is so cheap that it's like, well, why shouldn't I borrow money at 1% or 2% and replace my employees with robots and software, because the cost of those employees keeps rising while the cost of money makes it even more and more compelling to replace them with automation and software.
Right. Right. So let's talk about this money. So a couple things here. I mean, look, I guess we could imagine a utopia sort of a place, which is where humans always wanted to get to. And if we're lucky, we'll get back to what our hunter-gatherer forebears had, which was plenty of time, right? You know, isn't there an argument to be made here, which is like, well, listen, why are we shackled to this ideology of 40-hour work week? You know, that's a bare minimum. That's what it takes to earn a living. You know, France has sort of decoupled from that and said, how about 35? But, you're making a case here that if automation really goes forward, A, we don't need that many workers. And by the way, we have so few as it is already. I mean, you know, what, 130 million workers out of 320? I mean, it's less than half. It's just ridiculous. But maybe it's not ridiculous. Maybe it's okay. But wouldn't it be less ridiculous if instead of having 130 million people working their tails off and everybody else sort of kicking around, what if we could sort of, are you saying we could maybe distribute that out a little bit? Have everybody have a 20-hour work week? Is that one way this goes? Or how do we begin to make sense of this?
Well, Chris, that is one option. And a lot of people have find that a valuable idea. In other words, if we just cut the work week in half, at least everybody will have, you know, half the income. But of course, as you point out, it now takes two full-time jobs to maintain a quasi middle class existence. So what we're really saying, if we do that, is everybody is now going to be poor.
Yep.
And so that may be sustainable, but it's not the happy future everybody was promised. And so there's two issues that your question raises. One is, what is work? And, you know, that's another question we think we know the answer to, like, what is money? Well, we think that work is what's paid. But let me give you an example of work that it cannot possibly be profitable. Let's say that a town or community wants to put in a bike lane dedicated to bicycles only, no cars allowed. It's not a little bike lane that's created with a gallon of paint that paints a stripe on the road. This is a legitimate, real bike lane, like the kind you have in Europe, where bikes can operate safely. And why would they do this? Well, biking has so many benefits, right? It's good for the health. It takes cars off the road, reduces pollution. I mean, you know, the list goes on and on. It's an absolute economic win, right, on multiple levels. Well, where's the profit in building a bike lane? Is Google going to come in and build a bike lane so it can make a lot of money? No, there's absolutely no money to be made on this at all, because the benefits are generalized and they can't be scooped up by one company. So in the current arrangement, well, then the government taxes us all to raise the money, and then it hires, like, at enormous expense, some private contractor who's going to try to make as much money as possible to construct this bike lane. But if neither of those things is possible, like, in other words, the government doesn't have the money to do this, or there's no private enterprise that can make a profit off of it, where does that leave us? And so the point to me is, there's an enormous amount of work that would benefit our communities that can't be done and paid for in the current arrangement. And so what we really want to do is, we want a system that pays people to do this useful work that is not profitable and doesn't really align itself to governments that depend on high taxes.
Well, this is something you're touching on something as well. I love the really talking about what work is. I do agree that that's something maybe we all think we know, but maybe we should think that through a little bit more and make sure we're clear on that. Is something else that you're touching on is also touched on in our new book, Prosper, is this idea of how we find meaning in our lives, right? And that there are lots of different things and ways we can value both our experience in life and feel valuable and all of that. Work is very traditionally not just work. Work sounds like drudgery. So let me reshape it. When people can bring their gifts out and provide some measure of service to their community, and in return they're supported for those efforts. And now that might be money, right? We might call it work, right? That's how we combine those two things. I go out and I work and I get a paycheck, and so that's how I know I'm valued. But there might be another way to go about this. But really, isn't work really just a way for us to be productive and express ourselves and find a way to really keep ourselves not just occupied, but if you do it right, really grow into and become a master of whatever it is you're doing. That's fulfillment.
That's right, Chris. And that's one of the big holes, I think, in the current narrative, at least in my view, which is the current narrative is all dominated by consumerism. Mm-hmm. In other words, we're basically told every day, thousands of times a day, that our source of meaning and identity and pride is all in what we bought today or what
right.
we own, right? And so, and what's odd about that is it turns us into these sort of atomized, you know, individuals with no connection to any community, and it makes us very dependent on profitable economic activity. But it turns out that if we really look at that closely, that doesn't actually make us fulfilled. And so it's actually a false promise. And we all know this. And I think it's the source of a lot of anguish, unhappiness, and despair, that when people's livelihood is taken away, then that they lose their purpose, pride, and meaning. And just giving them free money to go buy stuff, to be a consumer, what I call the super welfare state of, you know, guaranteed income, that's not really providing them with the necessities of human life. It's actually a form of serfdom. You know, like, here's a few bucks for you to go spend, have a nice life. And if we look at human nature, as you say, going back to the way that we that humanity developed, our core identity and is a social one. In other words, we need to belong to a group. We need a chance to contribute to that group and perhaps even sacrifice for that group. And that's our source of pride, purpose, and meaning. And if we don't have that, we're going to be unhappy. And there was an article recently that came out from, I think, The Atlantic magazine, where people studied middle-aged Caucasian people in America, and discovered that their death rate is rising rapidly. They're dying from despair, was the conclusion of these sociologists. And to me, it's no mystery at all. The middle-aged Caucasians who are not highly educated and don't have opportunities for work, they are dying of despair because they've lost their sources of meaning.
Well, you know, you're raising a bunch of obviously very important points here. It looks to me like this robotic and automation trend is, I agree, it's not just advancing, it's going parabolic. We can expect more of that to continue. And yet we already can see all around us the impact of not just that automation, but the offshoring to the cheapest common denominator location, right? So in the United States, that's translated into a relative paucity of jobs, especially good jobs, and not a lot of opportunities for advancement for entire swaths of the economy at this point in time, particularly those who are not tied in at the hip to the insider trading information that the Fed gives to its favored clients and all of that. So it really feels like there's this growing disparity, not just in wealth but in opportunity. That's not really a recipe for social happiness, or let me, or what's the opposite of social unrest? Social rest.
Yeah, that's right, Chris. And you combine the rising wealth inequality, then I think one of the conclusions I came to is that if we could, people want to think that if only we could tax the top 0.1% and we could change the Fed and all that stuff, that we would fix all these problems. And what we're really talking about here is these problems cannot be fixed by just taxing the 0.1%, as good as that would feel, or abolishing the Fed. I mean, that would be a good first step, but the kind of conventional economic fixes, like more education to train a highly trained workforce, none of those things is going to really fix any of these things. So we need to ask, what kind of system do we want or need that would actually produce the output we want, which is guaranteed work for all, meaningful work, not just BS work, but meaningful work for everyone. And that would, of course, mean a stable or secure income, because ultimately our wealth and our income flows from performing work that's valuable in our community. You know, so if that's the system that we obviously want and need, and so that's the system I try to work on outlining.
Now that's interesting. Now is this dangerously close to Marxism? There isn't it that there's a, you know, this idea of work for everyone or something like that. I know that there are going to be people who are going to misinterpret that or wonder if that's where you're going with this. It feels. But to follow your train of thought to its conclusion, like these trends are already in play, and it's not a question of shall we go down this path where literally automation boots probably half the workforce out of productive enterprise, but that's where we're going. So your book then is about, okay, we're going there. How do we want to get there? Default, we all know what the default is, right? We just go there trying to both preserve our current system because this is the only system we know. So this is how it works, right? People work 40 hours and you have to get a mortgage from a bank and you have to pay interest on that loan, and that's how the system works, right? But if we, you're saying if we preserve both the status quo of how we operate plus allow this other big trend to come along, that just ends up in a very suboptimal place. And is that about right?
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. And so then my book sort of poses this question. If we could reset this socioeconomic system, start from scratch, what would we design? How would we do that? Because, you know, our natural state as humans is to look at the present and assume that that's the only way it could be. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm proposing is, if we look at the technologies that we that many of us use every day, like for instance Bitcoin, it's a digital currency. It's not created by a central bank. It's basically a form of decentralized money. That's pretty neat. What if we had a system that was global and similar to Bitcoin that wasn't controlled by the Fed or the central banks? And what if we had a system that was like Craigslist, which is, believe it or not, I believe it has 40 employees globally. I mean, in other words, we could create a global marketplace. There's, you know, with very little capital and labor required. And so the internet is enabling a lot of new technologies that in my view we could leverage into boosting the part of the economy that actually works and creates meaningful labor, which is the community economy, the local economy. And so why not leverage these technologies that we're already using all the time and put them into an integrated system that produces paid work for everyone that wants it? And I think it's possible.
And so in your book, you've got I guess this is like really a fresh start thinking, right? We just have to pretend as if instead of thinking that we have an ideology about how things are supposed to work, right? Sort of chuck that and start over and say, what systems are actually in play and how could they work? And can we reimagine that? And I have to confess at this point, Charles, you know, the thing that always I get tripped up on, that I don't know how to get around, is it's just our money system. As long as we just have this debt-based, interest-based money system, I can't see any other way around this except that everything has to constantly be going in a parabolic exponential direction.
And so one of the core ideas in my book is let's set aside the current system. And my idea is I don't need to replace or shut down the current, you know, state cartel, you know, money creation, however you want to describe it, our current economic system. That can just kind of run along as it's currently running, and it will end up where we all know it will end up with financial and financial crises and so on. But we could start a whole parallel system with a new kind of money, which I call the largent, which is, you know, based on the French word for money, l'argent. So and it would be created digitally when a community group created goods and services. So my kind of insight into the way that money should work or could work is, let's create money instead of out of thin air and then hand it to the super wealthy and the banks. Why don't we create money only when a community creates goods and services that are useful to that community? So it's not, what I'm proposing is a kind of money that is not going to replace gold and silver. It's a money that's specifically designed for greasing trade in goods and services. In other words, it's not a store of value. It's the kind of money that we know from history is used for everyday transactions. And so if we look back in history, when gold and silver were in short supply, say in the pre-Renaissance Europe, then people created money scripts and bills of sale, and they used a lot of this kind of script money because that's what they needed to get to function in everyday life. And so we know from history that these kinds of money actually work quite well, and that the only thing that destroys them is if somebody of some elite can create the money out of thin air. And what I'm proposing is, if money that is only created by the production of goods and services, and it's distributed to those people at the bottom of the pyramid who created the goods and services, then you've got a money that can't be inflated away like central bank money. And it's sort of based on the history of money, which is quite interesting. And David Graeber, who became famous as part of the Occupy movement, he wrote a book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, which I highly recommend to anybody that wants to explore money beyond the sort of conventional boundaries that we normally think of it as.
Well, that is all just absolutely fascinating. And who's your ideal reader of this book? Who did you write this for?
That's a good question, Chris. I think I wrote it for everyone who understands that the current system is just not sustainable, and we better start thinking about a new way of organizing money and work and community. Because if we don't, then we're going to be left with a nasty default of basically implosion and social disorder. And so I think we don't have to follow that path. We could start now and start thinking about how could a new system work and be beneficial to every participant in that system. And that's my book. It's an attempt at that. Let's design a system from scratch that actually works and is sustainable.
Well, what I love is it's taking a view of the big trends that are in play, and of course it fits right into the Peak Prosperity fold that way, because the future, there's all kinds of disruptions on the horizon, and this whole idea of automation is right here. It's already happening. There are plenty of people who've already been disrupted out of a job, and other people are unaware of how they're being disrupted, but they do know they're having a tough time finding a good job. They're sort of the silent dispossessed in this story. So this is all fantastic and fascinating. Where can people get their hands on this book?
Well, Chris, it's on Amazon as a Kindle ebook or as a print book. And you can find the links on my site at oftwominds.com. And I'm hoping that Adam will post a link on the Peak Prosperity site or in a Peak Prosperity email, so you can just click on that link and take a look at the book right from your Peak Prosperity page.
Of course we'll do that. Well, Charles, thank you so much for your time today, and thank you for writing this book. I think people are going to get a lot out of it. I'm looking forward to the conversations that are going to be elicited from this at Peak Prosperity.
Fantastic, Chris. Thanks so much for giving me a chance to talk about it.
My pleasure.